Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
This is the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Yo.
And Justin Robert Young.
That's me.
So, do we promise to dive into our picks in the After Things segment. Man, there's a lot of good content. I'm a third of the way into Neal Stephenson's new one, Seven Eves. I think I mentioned it last week because I just gotten it started. And do you guys think you're going to read it? Should I talk about it or keep it spoiler free? Or
I mean, I'd say keep it. I mean, if you want people to read it, then I would keep it spoiler free.
I mean, the conceit. I guess we could talk about the universe that it's set up. I don't think any of this is spoilery. Literally on the first page, you watch the moon blow up. Which sounds ridiculous, but the idea being that there's like a small, fast moving black hole left over from the creation of the universe is zipping through, and it happens to zip through the center of the moon, and it breaks apart. And at first everyone's like, yeah, now we have seven tiny moons. That's great. And then they start banging into each other and they're like, oh, let me run some numbers. And then it's like an exact date comes up where it's like, yeah, we got 2 years until there's so much debris that the atmosphere catches fire and all of the planet Earth is sterilized. And, as you can imagine, a lot of it is about the heroic effort to throw as much stuff into space as we can. And this doesn't take place modern day. It's clear from a few context clues that I don't know, it's anywhere from 15 to 40 years from now. So, there was one moment that I was out on a walk, and I just grinned involuntarily ear to ear there wasn't a lot of talk about, who did what, but they're talking about getting one of the first shipments in, and they say, and as the International Space Station docked with the Falcon Heavy, blah blah blah, like the casual name drop of SpaceX in there made me incredibly happy. But it's funny because much like The Martian, deals with a lot of kind of fictional technological solutions to very real stuff. Like you get to learn a lot about orbital mechanics and so on. It's all underneath this heavy blanket of, knowing that the world is ending and the government handing out euthanasia pills and everyone going to work because they don't know what else to do. And it's like the whole world got, a diagnosis that the cancer is terminal and stuff. I'm about a third of the way in, and we're finally at a place where I don't know. There's at least something to look up to, because the whole first third of the book has been nothing but just grappling with, like, no, seriously, this is what the end of the world would look like in this situation, and this is what people would do.
Well, it's no secret. It's about colonizing space. That the book deals with that.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
But so far the whole first third has been very heavy, very sad. And I'm looking forward to it moving into a happier place, which Tensor Guy in the chat promises does happen. I'm only a third of the way in.
I loved Anathem.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to get much into in many of his other stuff that he's done in the last 15 years, but Anathem is like one of my favorites of all time.
Anathem is a good comparison because Anathem was a strange world, but by the time it ended, I loved being there. I loved the strangeness and the otherness of it. In fact, it's the only audiobook that I finished and immediately went back and started again just so I could experience the beginning of it, knowing what everything meant and not being overwhelmed by the jargon.
Same for me. I did the same thing.
But Seven Eves so far, I mean, it's as rich and as detailed a world as Anathem, but not as fun. not a place I'm really excited and thrilled to be at the moment. So
yeah,
and that's a Seven Eves.
I finished the book Hope, Entertainer of the Century, which is the Bob Hope biography by Richard Zoglin. And I think it's totally fantastic. It's just a great overview of a guy whose legacy stretched from, he started off doing dance halls, then he went to vaudeville, then from vaudeville he went to, he did Broadway, and then from Broadway he started to do radio and film and television. This is a guy that's made, had six different kind of careers at points at which everybody else drops off. And I guess that's a subject of a George Burns book. George Burns talks about all his friends and just the fact that people who couldn't make that jump. And Bob Hope was a guy that was making, was born in 1903, you know, shortly after the Wright brothers. And this was a guy that was still doing stuff, you know, up until like 1990, you know, in the 90s even. And you know, finally just his conditions, you know, his early Alzheimer's and all that got to be too bad. But he lived to be 100. He lived to be 100 years old. Incredible. So as a, I learned a lot from there. I mean, the guy, his he was a workhorse, a constant philanderer, but it wasn't a, you know, a sensational book that like, oh, let us tell you about, here's a thing. You know, most people didn't know that. But
yeah,
that's not the narrative. Like, here's his secret. Like, guess what? Most rich and powerful men in Hollywood are like that. What was really incredible was this guy's work ethic. You know, they got into the fact that, you know, he wasn't necessarily a hugely deep guy. You know, the people, you know, you talk to him and he's a friendly, amiable guy. He was not a guy that reminisced. He was a guy that was about the work. When he was 85 years old or something, he did something like 170 appearances that year.
I mean, to be honest, he sounds like, to be honest, from what you've said, born in a different time, it sounds like Jay Leno, you know, like from everything we hear about Jay.
There is a lot of similarity between, you look at, you have some comedians are guys who do their thing and that are deeply personal, you know, deeply private, like Johnny Carson and Steve Martin. You know, these are guys that do their thing and they don't, they're not like the life of the party in the middle of the room. Hope and Leno are, would, could, you know, Jay Leno drives himself to the car shows, hangs around, talks to everybody, does that. Bob Hope was like that. Absolutely. There was a lot of similarities between the two of them. And, you know, and that's a, just an interesting sort of like different. Letterman's another private guy. Letterman goes and does his shows. Then Letterman's off in his ranch in Montana's. And I also think it has to do with like guys who tend to be more intellectual. Carson was an intellectual. Steve Martin's an intellectual, you know, Letterman's a, you know, pretty thoughtful kind of guy. There's this weird sort of thing between the intellectual entertainer who's on and then they're completely off and don't want to be on versus guys like Hope and Leno who just seem to be like, hey, everybody, how's it going?
What did you think of the final week of Letterman, both you guys? I actually didn't watch any of that, but you know.
I didn't watch it.
You didn't? Man, how weird.
I watched the clips. I didn't watch any of the full episodes.
Okay, then I'm thrilled to hear this because, like, if you told me when I was in college that, like it would be a news event and yet not me and all of my closest friends just wouldn't even be bothered to find out that stuff, like, what does that say about the changing face of the way we consume television now? That like, what was our big outlet for remotely countercultural, sarcastic, you know, one of our late, he was our guy when it came to late night.
Yeah, but then it became a machine and a business, and not taking anything from what he did, but it was not. He was a guy that was clocking in and doing a very good job of it. It wasn't like, you know, the days of Monkey Cam and stuff like that were behind us.
Well,
you know,
no, I don't think that's what it was, or at least not for me. I think that it's not that he changed, but the structure changed to where the late night show, the opportunity to say the things that were on everyone's mind that you couldn't, you know, say out in public, and you had to wait till the sun went down and the kids went to bed to say it. Like, the internet destroyed that. Like, the internet destroyed the relevance of having that pulpit, I think.
I mean, I don't know that it's I mean, my experience is different than yours. And I think I look at, you know, who's a guy that I think is doing something really clever is like John Oliver. I think John Oliver is doing a very, very clever and saying, OK, everything's happening in the moment. So let me do a thing that goes back in time a week and says, here is this thing and let me sort of address it. And there's a reason why I think why I like that versus you know, the Jeff Daniels thing?
The newsroom?
The newsroom.
Newsroom, you know, where newsroom was, you know, just, you know, just.
It was Sorkin as hell.
And I mean, I love Sorkin, but that was just, you know, wish fulfillment. Like, you know, like, and like people like, yeah, it was so great when he said that. It's like, all right, you're just make believe. It's like me wanting to pretend I'm wearing Tony Stark Iron Man armor, you know. But anyhow, but I think that there is some very clever stuff going on out there. I think for me, for like Letterman kind of ran out of surprises for me.
Well, I think there is undeniably an element where, you know, I think what never went away for Letterman was the monologue. The monologue has kind of always been, it was for Leno, it was for Carson. I mean, Carson famously was emailing, faxing and, you know, sending monologue jokes to Letterman for years after he left, you know, the Tonight Show, because he just couldn't help but write these one-liners. They were just always a thing. I think that never went away for Letterman. What I think changed for him, and he never really was the final kind of nail in the coffin, was his heart attack. You know, Letterman famously used to, prior to his heart attack, take two Hershey's chocolate bars, break them up into their little squares, stack two towers of squares up, eat all of them, and then drink like four cups of coffee and go out. And that was his like ritual to do it. And eventually, like when his heart attack happened, that was part of the behavior that he had to knock off. I think his mental desire kind of went away. And also I think there came a time when he could find purpose in life beyond his expression on that show, which had come to define him, which once you kind of let go of that, here's what I do think. I do agree with you, Brian, is like, it's not necessarily that the internet changed everything, but competition got wider, attention got thinner. And now if you're not trying your hardest, there's somebody else who is. You know, there's a staff of writers at The Daily Show, at The Colbert Report, that are working diligently because they want their legacy to be these shows, and they want to beat, they want to be the thing that everybody remembers. And I think that for him, that went away. Now, that didn't mean that he wasn't amazing. I mean, the greatest relationship I have with The Letterman Show was probably in the late 90s when I was staying with my father in St. Thomas, and I would watch CBS was the only station that they got in St. Thomas of the American broadcasting channels, and I would watch Letterman religiously and would, you know, just die at, you know your current events and know your cuts of meat and, you know, all these kind of late Letterman sort of bits. And I loved it. I loved him. I mean, he's a genius, but I do think that he ran out of steam. And I think it was pretty clear, you know, in the last 10 years that his children, people that he inspired, comedically had, you know, struck down the master in terms of who was doing the kind of comedy that he made famous.
Right. And I, you know, I think we sort of ended up in kind of two different spaces, but you know, my point being, like, to me, the remarkable thing is not that his show is ending, but just that, that in the wake of his show ending, three people who love what he does, just, you know, in a world now where we're just spoiled for choice. And there's so many different nuanced flavors of, I mean, it used to be, if you wanted that kind of sarcastic humor, he was it, and that was it in the entire all of broadcast landscape that you got.
Sure, I think like, you know, there was a kind of a really wonderful sort of period between, like, I think like 1975 and maybe 1985. You look at, you know, you had, you know, Letterman coming onto the scene and doing really clever and, you know, and taking that late night slot and doing anything and everything, monkey cams, things like that, bringing on guests that you would never put on another talk show. You would never put it on because it could totally derail everything, but it was going to, you know, Kmart and bits like that and stuff.
Crispin Glover, like, that famous weird ass.
Never invited back, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But you know, but like, there are the people, you look at who do they bring back, because like, oh, we love the way it gets derailed, you know, Penn and Teller, et cetera. Saturday Night Live. There was a time back in the day, you watched Saturday Night Live, you might see a comedian do that spot. You might see somebody else other than a musician go in there and do that variety spot, and it was really spontaneous and felt special and different. They did an entire episode about when Buckwheat got shot that was a parody of the Ronald Reagan getting shot, and that was brilliant. It was brilliant. And then they stopped doing those kinds of things. And Letterman stopped doing those kinds of things that became, you know, they would do these little outrageous, funny bits and stuff, but they really, once it became, this is what it is, I know I could watch a show today that wouldn't be that different than 3 years ago or whatever. It was not going to push that. And that's when it started being like, okay, you know, this is the same format that everybody else follows now. There, I could interchange these bits with other shows to a degree, you know. The only difference, like, okay, well, Fallon will invent a reason to spontaneously pretend they're trying to sing, you know. But that's the thing for me is like, yeah, just it's the envelope pushing ceased to be there. So that's why I kind of lost interest in Letterman, because it was like it just felt the same.
So,
I mean, I do think that, like, there was a time in which that time slot and that idea was synonymous with irreverent comedy, you know, and that was something that certainly seeped beyond beyond that point in terms of visual irreverent comedy. You know, yeah. The sketch comedy was, you know, became bigger at different times during the day, and that was, you know, even at the point where he first went to CBS, you know, and that's, I think ultimately that's also part of it, is the idea, you know, that maybe the show was never, you know, David Letterman will always be artistically remembered more for The Late Show than he will be, for Late Night. Late Night with David Letterman than he will be for The Late Show.
Yeah, agreed. Are you guys going to check out the Wachowski new thing on Netflix, Sense8? Yeah, probably not.
I've nobody's given me a compelling reason.
You know, it's beautiful. I'm going to watch all of it, I think. The first episode really is long on the set pieces. It's about eight people who find themselves feeling each other's emotions and sensations or whatever. And it's got Naveen Andrews, the guy from
Saeed.
Lost. Yeah, Saeed. You know, and it has an interesting setup, but it is long on the personal vignettes and short on the moving forward with the weirdness. However, by the end of the third episode, there is a really cool crossover moment where one of the eight people is a cage fighter, right? Basically, and or underground boxer, and another one is a disenfranchised small business owner who just got robbed by some local thugs, and goes to get the money, or they steal his mom's pills, and there's this cool crossover moment as sort of the skills of them are being lent, you know, interchangeably. I don't know. It sounds like, from what I'm seeing in the chat, there are people that kind of comes and goes. I don't know. I'll plow through it and let you know if it's really worth it. But for right now, it's really fascinating. And you could see some interesting echoes of what feels like, knowing the story of the Wachowskis, feels like a personal take on stuff. You know, there's a transgender character who's and it's curious, because it sounds like it's somebody who's fully transgender fully transitioned, I guess, and in a relationship with another girl. And then there's another character who is a Mexican action movie star who's deeply closeted and needs to cover it up at all costs. And so one character is in San Francisco, and the others, you know, in Mexico. I don't know. It's some fascinating stuff in there. I just hope they tie it together and make me just excited about butt kicking there.
I'm going to take a wild guess, knowing the Wachowskis,
and
say,
record.
Hold your breath.
Hold your breath.
I dug what they tried for in Cloud Atlas. You know, I loved the fact that Cloud Atlas, they were trying to make a film into that. They were trying to tell this big kind of story and all that. And I enjoy it on certain levels. And I appreciate that. I read Sense8 and I read like this. Yeah, it sounds like a very personable kind of thing that's, you know, nominally, I don't get a lot of sensational interest out of those sorts of things. I'm kind of like, you know, like, oh, this is what I want to do with myself. Well, that's great. You know, you should feel like you're a welcome person anywhere and everywhere. That's the extent of it, you know?
Yeah, I get, you know? The problem with Sense8 that I kind of had looking at it on a conceptual level is my relationship with the Wachowskis' work past the first Matrix has been fairly spotty. I really dug Cloud Atlas. I have not girded myself to try and watch Jupiter Ascending yet, but from everything that I know about Jupiter Ascending, it's certainly, you know, it is reminiscent of when everybody was really, really into the resurrection of Eddie Murphy after Dreamgirls, and then he immediately follows it up with Norbit. I feel like we were all kind of ready to give the Wachowskis another chance after Cloud Atlas, and then they drop Jupiter Ascending into our laps. The idea of a project with them, shepherded by them, that is A, longer, and B, has less oversight over their ideas did not necessarily seem like the most delightful way to spend my time.
Yeah. And it's weird now too, because I've heard people tell me like, oh, Wayward Pines, that's pretty good. You know, I've heard a couple of people tell me that, and I'm like, I don't know, Shyamalan, but I'm like, well, like, listen, I dug the hell out of Unbreakable, you know, and I enjoyed Signs. And so I'm like, yeah, there's a guy in there that can really entertain me. And if that's there, then that's awesome. Then I want to see that. But it's this weird kind of thing where, you know, with Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, the idea that you can create something and it doesn't, you know, when you do TV, you know, like broadcast television, it's like, you know, if it doesn't hit that night, first night it comes out, they write it off. You know, it's like, nope, it's done for the most part. There are exceptions to that kind of thing. Or they pick their winners and losers ahead of time, and they don't give things the chance to sort of breathe or whatever, or find audiences.
Wait, this is which institution? Netflix or?
Which one?
Well, I'm sorry. Are you talking about Netflix right now when you're saying they pick their winners and losers?
Broadcast.
Okay. Yeah. Often
that, you know, they figure out what they'll sink money into and what they won't. But then, you know, and then ultimately, you know, where these things are decided, you know, I mean, and it comes down to, it's like, you know, you can have something that's very clever, but it won't get the chance to succeed. Cable's a little bit better about that, you know, but with Netflix and stuff, it's interesting, you know, they, you know, like in HBO makes bets on stuff and a bit better, you know, they have a better sort of, they can take a longer approach, but that's the hard part. And it's cool though, is it like, Netflix with like Daredevil's probably been one of the most successful original series for Netflix ever.
I mean, artistically, I would say so. Although, you know, by the awards numbers, I think it's Orange is the New Black, right?
I'm talking viewership. Oh, actual. Okay.
Well,
as far as anyone knows, I mean,
yeah, I was about to say they don't release those numbers, right?
No, what I'm saying, as far as what the firms have been tracking that stuff and trying to say what have been what we know, and said, as I said, probably one of the most successful ever based upon that tracking data.
Wow,
it's been Orange is the New Black critically, absolutely, but it's like you take a look at Mad Men, which. You would think from the attention it got, it was a hugely watched show. But Mad Men was not a hugely watched show, but critically it was a very successful show. But from actual watching, like for Netflix, the rumor has it, the story is that it has been ratings wise, as far as total viewers, it's been like one of the most watched things. There was a thing came out in Variety, which was it tracked. What the trying to guesstimate what that is, and again, it's probably no less or no accurate than other things. But they list like what the most watched percent of subscribers who tuned in for the first 30 days after each series premiered. Daredevil had like almost double anything else, including House of Cards, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Marco Polo, Bloodline, etc. I don't see Orange is the New Black here too, which certainly is a popular show. But anyhow, point is. There's a show that had a wonderful word of mouth too. You know, it was one of these things that people talk about. Have you seen it? Have you seen it? Have you seen it? And then you got a chance to see it. And so much of now, like you say, you know, Brian's brings up Sense8, and I'm like, people rave about it. I'll go watch it.
Yeah.
If I'm out here and raving about it, I'm not going to go watch it.
Yeah.
Well, what's fascinating with Netflix is where our idea is on their batting average, because you know, by the nature of their just like, you can watch whatever you want sort of model, like, their failures sort of just recede to the back very quickly, and their successes remain kind of front and center. And so every time that you look at there and you see like, oh, look, Daredevil, Orange is the New Black, House of Cards. Those are all things that people I know like and people talk about very fondly. Mm-hmm. Look, Netflix is a great place for original drama. And yet who knows what their batting average is. I mean, I would suspect it's probably certainly better than broadcast, where 90% of everything is canceled within five episodes. But it's amazing. They've done a really, really good job of minimizing their failures.
Plus, also, they have the ability to do the unusual, like, take something like Hemlock Grove, where it's like normally in the broadcast world, you're like, not enough people are watching. We're pulling the plug because we suspect that this bandwidth could be better served with something else. But knowing the rabid nature of fans of the horror genre, you know, I assume that they're able to look and come back and say, hey, it made this much money. We had this much share. We had this much people. We suspect that we could give you this much reduced budget and you could do it again if you want. And then it's like, you know, you're Eli Roth and you're like, yeah, we're happy to do it at that amount or not or whatever. And keep in mind, I made that whole situation up. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those things where there are so many solutions that allow to keep things alive that in a broadcast environment or cable television, you'd have to make this binary, you know, do or don't do.
Yeah, well, in broadcasting cable too, it's like you take a show like How I Met Your Mother. That was a show that if you just looked at the ratings, it didn't justify its renewal. But where it fit into their block of programming and what they went to their advertisers with and said, well, we bring our demo down. We get a younger demo, which you want. And so we'll lose money in the slot on this show, you know, to keep it going, you know, and it gets into these very, very tricky sorts of reasons why things keep on. And it comes down to is somebody has to pay for it. And when you're Netflix, you're like, oh, we need to give people a reason to spend $9 a month with us, you know, and it's much more you're trying to please the person paying you, which is the subscriber.
To be honest,
there's also this difference between broadcast television and Netflix, which is broadcast television is King's Landing, right? Whoever sits on the throne not only needs to make sure that they are justifying that the reign that they have is fruitful for their network, but also that they are getting the credit, and killing and strangling the heirs of previous kings is a very big part of that. Turnover.
Yeah.
Guides decision making on a level that it has not at Netflix, which has only had one CEO and has a little bit more of a stable long term solution of like, hey, look, let's put this money here. If it makes us money, then good. We do more of it. If it doesn't, then we don't. Let's get aggressive on things that we believe in. Let's and whether or not that goes well or bad is part of a longer term solution in a way that you really just can't if you are running a broadcast network because, you know, nothing's promised beyond next season.
Yeah. Hey, guys, I'd hate to bug out early, but we only have a few more minutes of sunset to record the stand-ups for Scam School, so I'm going to have to go soon.
Oh, Brian.
I know. It's on me, bro.
You and your go-getter mentality. When will enough be enough, Brian?
Hey, by the way, that secret project is looking real good at happening, the one I texted you.
You just make sure they save it in case you change your mind.
Yeah. Well, and,
you know,
and
they can put it back on you.
Put it back on me. Yeah, okay, I guess, sure.
Okay, Brianna.
Yeah. Blink. That's going to be my new thing. I'm going to say something subtle and then go, blink.
Yeah. Cool.
Dude, thanks, guys. It's been after.
You're goddamn right it is.
It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.